On Friday, I left you with some sort of exercise on quadratic functions. So I told you what a quadratic function is, so that f of x there. And I also wrote the explicit expression with all the components of the x vector. And the unique assumption we made is that Q is symmetric matrix. And we checked that this is not a restrictive assumption, because you can always change the coefficients in such a way that Q is symmetric. Okay? Just since XK, XL provides the same as XL, XK, if you have different coefficients, you sum them up and you divide it by 2. So that is the unique assumption. And I ask you to compute the partial derivatives, first order and second order partial derivatives of this function. You do it easily if you have the explicit expression rather than the matrix compact expression. I will not dig all the computation. You can do it by yourself. I hope you have already done it and you find it in the notes. I just want you to focus on this. You use the explicit expression, then you fix an I and you keep the derivative. It's the derivative of a polynomial. So you can do it quickly. The fact is that on the first term you have to consider that xi comes up when you have k equal I, but also when you have l equal I. So it comes twice. This is the reason of these two terms here. Okay? And then when you take the derivative of the second term, it is meaningful only for k equal I, so you have bi, and so on. If you make all the computation, the partial derivative of f with respect to xi is the ith element of the vector qx plus bi. Okay? So if you want to see it in a matrix form, since that is the ith component of the gradient, it means that the gradient is the matrix qx plus b. Sorry, it's the matrix q multiplied by x plus b. Okay? This is important. We will use this a little bit. So essentially, it looks like that you are acting in the same way as if x were a number and not a vector. Okay? And so once you have this, and you want to take a second order partial derivative, let's say with respect to xj, you have to take the derivative of x with respect to xj of this expression here. So here it is. It is meaningful only when l is equal j, because it's the only term in which xj comes up. So this is qij, because this is a constant and all other terms do not depend on xj. And so what you get, if you take the derivative with respect to xi first and xj first, you get qij, where qij is the ij element of the matrix Q. So if you take the Hessian, that is the matrix whose elements are these second order derivatives, what you get is exactly Q. Okay? Again, if it were a number, you would be doing the derivative of the gradient, so this Qx plus B will become Q. Okay? For n equal 1. So these are important, okay? Because we will see that quadratic functions have a huge relevance, and we know that the gradient is this qx plus b, and the Hessian is the matrix Q of coefficients of terms of second order and does not depend on the point. It's the same at every point. Okay? So this is what I left you on Friday. And before starting the true course, I just want you to show some pictures on the calculus background we focused on the previous lectures. So let me see. First, I show you the graph of some functions, some of the functions that we used as examples. So I took the norm for n. This is the norm in R2. Okay. So and the graph of the function is this. I draw it in the square -1, -1, -1, 1. Okay, it's a function done this way. We will use these pictures many times. The darker the color is, the lower the value is. The hotter, more red the color is, bigger values are what you are getting. Okay, so dark, lower value, red, bigger values. So, and if you just project the function on the domain, so here on the square -1, -1, -1, 1, you can, so this is the domain of a part of the domain of the function. You can color areas with the same colors you had here in this picture. You project them down, and so you see that in this area you have lower values and they are increasing as you go this way. Clearly, you can see that in R2 values are increasing along circles. This is another function we use to make some computational derivatives, that is the sine of p x1 times x2. This is the graph of the function in the same square as before. I think I have also a bigger square. And so the function is doing something like a wave. Okay? Clearly you have a trigonometric function inside, so this is the behavior. We will see during the course that this is a pretty good function, and this is a bad function. Meaning that we will be able to compute the minima of function which are similar to this pretty well, where we are in trouble to compute minima and maxima of functions like this. And hopefully today I will introduce the basic concept on which these two of the classes of the of function which are, let's say, good and bad. So this is the projection on the domain of the function. This is another function that we used. I used this function to show you a case in which what was this? You had the directional derivatives, but the function was not differentiable. The graph of the function is this. It has a strange behavior around zero. And if you look at it on the domain, projected on the domain with colors, you see that you have constant values along parabolas, as we actually did with precise computation. And then, last function that we use, this is another pretty strange function that we had, and this is its graph, and this is the projection of the values on the domain. Oh, I lost something. Okay. Then I want to show you something about Taylor's formulas. We have seen three Taylor's formulas. First order Taylor formula. First order Taylor formula with a precise expression for the residual, a reminder, if you like this term best. And second order Taylor's formula. Okay? And we discussed the fact that the first order formula gives you some sort of linear approximation. Okay? Gives you it's a constant value plus a linear function, while the second order Taylor's formula gives you a quadratic approximation. And I want to show this thing to you on this pretty easy function of two variables, minus x1 up to the fourth power minus x2 squared. Okay? You can easily compute partial derivatives of this function, first and second order partial derivatives. Let's start with, this is the graph of the function. Okay? It's a function done like this. And, here I switch colors. It's the same. Dark is low values, red is bigger values. So let's take 0, 0. And let's make Taylor's formula. First order. This is the first order for f at x if you forget about the residual. Well, you compute this, and you will find that this is always zero. Okay? So that the tangent hyperplane, since which in this case is an actual plane, since the graph is in R3, so it is given by x and this value, here it is, x1, x2, and the value of the first order approximation, which is always zero. So the tangent hyperplane is described by this set. If this is the graph of the function, the tangent hyperplane is this. In 0, 0 is this. Okay? Is the very dark horizontal plane you have up there and touches the graph of the function in 0, 0. We can make it in another point. Let's say x1 is equal 0 and x2 is equal 2 over 5. So minus 2 over 5. So minus 0.4. And if you compute the first order Taylor approximation, you get this affine function, linear term plus a constant value. So the tangent hyperplane this time is given by this formula, okay? The point and the value of the first order Taylor's formula, and it is this plane if you draw it, which touches the graph in 0, 0, 4, which is here. Minus 0, 4, sorry, which is here. Okay? You can see that in both examples, the tangent hyperplane is always above the graph of the function. And then, you see that as you go farther and farther away from 0 minus 0.4, the approximation gets worse and worse. Okay? Here the function is going down while the approximation is telling you to go up. Okay? So, as I already told you, approximations are good when you are close to the point. So, I zoom close to the point, and this is what you get. So, rather than having -1.1 times -1.1, I took -0.2 and -0.15, -0.65, so something in where our point is at the center. And if I scale back, the third axis, the axis of values, in the same scale we had before, this is what I get. So you see that it's hard to distinguish the function from the first order approximation, okay, from the tangent hyperplane. We can make also approximations using the second order Taylor's formula. So you compute this quadratic function, so you have the gradient but also the SM matrix. If the point is 0, 0, this is what you get. Okay? This simple expression. So the quadratic approximation, the graph of the quadratic approximation is given by x1, x2 minus 2x2 squared. Okay? For each x. This is again the graph of the function. If you draw also the quadratic approximation is this one. Okay? This one. Actually, as you can see, it depends only on x2. So it's a parabola repeated for all x's, for all x1, for all the values of x1. So here it is. If you zoom on the area, this is the function, and this is the quadratic approximation. If you keep zooming, okay? You don't keep zooming. You restore the original length of the third axis. You get that the approximation is pretty good. We can do it once again with the other point that we consider, 0 minus 2 over 5. You get a different expression for second order Taylor's formula. So the quadratic approximation is this one. And if you draw it, the quadratic approximation is this one, okay? And they do touch in this point, 0 minus 0.4, up there, okay? You see that this time the quadratic approximation, the graph of the quadratic approximation and of the function intersect in many points. Here is a little bit of zoom, and here I restore the original dimensions. Okay? So you see that in this case the approximation is good, but not as good as in the other point on a similar domain. So this picture were just to show you that really, if you are close to a point, you can try to replace a function with the linear or quadratic approximation given by Taylor's formulas. Okay? And clearly, if you are dealing with a linear function or a quadratic function, you are able to study it better than a generic function, because linear function and quadratic function are easy to study and have very good properties. Okay?
So if you have a question, doubts or curiosities, you can ask. Otherwise, we can actually start the real course with our subject. So, I introduce you all the background material we are going to use in both semesters. So that now we can start focusing on optimization problems. Lecture notes have been updated so that you can find also the notes for today's lecture on our web pages. So, as I already told you in the first lecture, we will concentrate on this problem. We have a function f from Rn into R, and we have a subset V of Rn, okay? And we want, for instance, to compute the minima of F over D. At which point in D, F takes the minimum value. So this is very generic form of optimization problem. I will formalize definition for optimal points in a few minutes. Just let me introduce you some sort of classification of optimization problems. You can classify optimization problems according to the property of function f and set D. The first big difference is between the case in which D is the full Rn and the case in which D is a proper subset of Rn. In the first case, we are speaking of unconstrained optimization, and in the second case, we are speaking of constrained optimization. And in constrained optimization, we can roughly consider two situations. The situation in which D is finite, so it's a finite number of points, or at most, let's say, a countable number of points. And otherwise. If F is finite or countable, there are names for the case in which D is a subset of vectors in Rn whose components are all 0 or 1. Okay? This is a finite set, so this is a case in which D is finite. This is combinatorial optimization. Okay.
I think many of you have seen combinatorial optimization problems in the past, at least in the operation research course. Another relevant situation when D is finite or countable is when D is made of vectors whose components are integer numbers, positive or negative integer numbers. And this is generally called integer, but not optimization, but programming. And let me just to explain why programming. In the 50s, or no, also in the 40s, optimization problems like this were also called programs. Okay, so this is also called a program with a pretty different meaning from what a computer scientist thinks now of a program. It comes from the military field, because some of the first optimization problems that were deeply studied in the 40s in the US were actually logistic problems for troops. And so they were trying to make an optimal schedule of operations. Okay, on logistic operations. So, some sort, they were trying to make the programs of things to do in which order and how to do them. So the name programs comes from that, and today you still find the name programming a huge lot when you are dealing with optimization. For instance, it's integer programming is used much more than integer optimization. Okay. Well, if f is not finite and f is not countable, you generally speak of continuous optimization. This is a bit improper, because here continuous somehow refers to the fact that the structure of D is continuous in the space, but it is not necessarily the case. And also, when you speak of continuous optimization, you are imagining that your objective function f is at least continuous. Okay? So the term is generally used when D is uncountable, but you are underlying the assumption that also F is a continuous function. Actually, optimization for this continuous function is pretty hard, and you don't have tools to work with. Actually, to have good tools, we need some sort of calculus, and you don't have a good calculus if you don't have a continuous function. And okay, so these distinctions are all based on D. You can clearly classify optimization problems also according to function, to the kind of function f you have. Okay. And the first meaningful distinction on f is the case in which f is linear from the case in which f is non-linear. In the first case, you generally speak of linear programming. Operation research course, second year of the undergraduate program, for instance. In the other case, you speak of nonlinear optimization or also nonlinear programming. A couple of books in the reference list I made for you are called nonlinear programming. So what we will be focusing on, we will be focusing on continuous optimization with non-linear functions, so non-linear continuous optimization, both in the unconstrained and constrained case. Roughly, in the first semester, we will spend our time on the unconstrained case, and in the second semester with the constrained case, roughly, okay? Because we will focus a bit more on unconstrained problems than on constrained ones. Okay, so now you have a number of terms, so when you hear these words, you know what people are talking about. So, now, let me start to formalize all the basics for an optimization problem. So, we have already seen this definition a couple of times, but now I give it really formally. We say that X bar in Rn is a global minimum point of our optimization problem if two conditions hold. The first one requires that X is feasible, that is, X belongs to the set D, X bar belongs to the set D. We are looking for minima in that set. And the second condition is that F of X bar is less or equal than F of X for each X in D. Okay? What you expect it to be. In this case, f at x bar is also called the optimal value of the optimization problem. Actually, if I really want to be formal, the optimal value of our problem P is the infimum of this set of real numbers. All the values, the set of all values that F takes over D. Okay? So this is a set of real number. The infimum of this set is called optimal value. Clearly, if a global minimum point exists, the value of the function at that point is the optimal value. Okay? But you may have an optimal value with no corresponding global minimum point. And we already seen such an example. Just take in one variable minus e at x, or if you like, you can also take the minus away if you like it best, and you can take d the whole Rn, or let's say d, no, the whole R, sorry, or the set of non-negative numbers. The optimal value is zero. This function is always greater or equal than zero, okay? And you can find x
indeed such that the value of f at x is arbitrarily close to zero. But you cannot find any point at which f is zero. Okay? So a global minimum point requires to get to achieve the optimal value. So this is a case in which you have an optimal value, but you don't have a corresponding global optimal solution, global minimum point. Okay? And if the optimal value is minus infinity, so the infimum of this set is minus infinity, you generally say that the minimization problem P is unbounded by below. And short addition to the definition, a global minimum point is called strict if the inequality holds as a strict inequality whenever x indeed is different from x bar. Okay? So, a global minimum point is strict if 2 holds in this way, f at x bar is less than f at x for each x in D which is different from x bar. Okay? If a global minimum point is strict, it's the unique minimum point of the problem. Okay? Because if you have this in a strict inequality, there cannot be 2 points with the same this property. There's another definition which is as relevant as this. And is the definition of a local minimum point, which is roughly the same idea, but rather than requiring to be the minimum point on the whole set D, you just ask that it is a minimum point in an appropriate ball centered in the point. Okay? So if you restrict the definition, this part of the definition to be not on the whole D but on the points of D which are in a ball close to the point, you get the definition of a local minimum point. So x bar in Rn is called a local minimum point of P if it is visible, means x bar belongs to P, and there exists some radius epsilon greater than zero such that for each x, now let's see, that f at x bar is less or equal than f at x for each x which belongs to D and also to the ball of center x bar and radius epsilon. So it is a minimum point if a local minimum point means that it is a local, that it is a minimum point if only if you look close to the point. Okay?
If it is a global minimum point, find the ball.
So there's an obvious relationship between the two definitions. A global minimum point is also a local minimum point, okay, but not vice versa. Okay, so any global minimum point is also local minimum point.
And for local minimum point, you can have the same definition of a strict local minimum point, just replacing less or equal with less. Okay? For all x in the ball and in the set, which are different from the point itself. I'll draw you a picture. Just in one variable to make this clearer. So, how can I draw? Okay, so n equal 1, this is the graph of f. Okay, and these values are the same. Okay, so this is a global minimum point. Okay, the function is always greater or equal to the value of the function at this point. Okay, it is not strict because there are other points at which you get the same value. Okay? This is a local minimum point. This is a local minimum point because if you focus, let's say, on this ball, this interval, you are actually getting the minimum value there. If you consider your function only in this ball, this is a minimum point. So this is a local minimum point. And it is strict. Okay? Because there is no other point in an appropriate neighborhood in which the function takes the same value. Okay? This point is also a local minimum point. Okay? Because if you take this ball, this interval, the function takes always the same value. So each point here is a local minimum point. Okay? But none of them is strict. Okay, so global minimum point, local minimum point, strict local minimum point, which is not strict. Okay? Notice this global minimum point is not a strict global minimum point, but if you consider it a local minimum point, it is strict. Because, let's see, in this neighborhood, no other point takes the same value for f. Okay? So there's another difference we can take care of, and it is the difference between local and global optimization. In global optimization, you are looking for global minima. Okay? In local optimization, you are looking for local minima. Okay? The two things may be very different. Looking for global minima is generally much harder than looking for local minima. Okay. Actually, all the methods we will be developing are able to spot local minima and not global minima. Okay. In optimization, the distinction between algorithms for global and local minima is roughly the same that you have between P and M and MP in other types of algorithms. Well, you could be lucky. A function could be such that all its local minima are also global minima. Okay? If the function is not this one, but for instance, this one, all these are both local and global minima, and there is no and there is no other local minimum point, because whenever you take another point, here the values are lower, but here the values are bigger. Okay. Indeed, we can identify a class of problems for which this property holds. Okay. And I need a couple of definitions for it. So I'll give you the definition and then we take a break. So first definition is about sets. A set V in Rn is called convex if it has the following property. Whenever you take two points x and y in the set D and you take any number between 0 and 1, the point lambda times x plus 1 minus lambda times y belongs to D. So you have x, you have y. For lambda that moves from 0 to 1, this point is describing the segment which unites y and x. Okay. So this definition is telling you that whenever two points are in the set, also the entire segment in Rn which unites the two points must be in the set. So a set is convex if it has this property. Whenever two points belong to the set, the whole segment which unites the two points belongs to the set. So this is not a convex set. And the second definition is about functions. And you say that the function f, so, no, first of all, Consider a convex set D in R. A function f from Rn to R is called convex on the set D if
we have the following properties.
Whenever you take x and y in Rn and you take any number lambda between 0 and 1, the value of the function at the point lambda times x plus minus 1 minus lambda times y is less or equal than lambda times the value of f at x plus 1 minus lambda times the value of f at y. And the function is called strictly convex if you have the strict inequality whenever x and y are different and lambda is not equal to 0 or 1. Because when lambda is equal to 0 or 1, this is x or y. So that strict inequality cannot hold. Last definition, a function is called, let me write it in another color, concave if, switching the sign, the function is convex. So a function f is concave if minus f is convex, or if you want to give the definition independently, here you don't have less or equal, but you have greater or equal. Okay, so let's take a break, and then I'll show you that if f is convex and d is convex, then any local minimum point of the problem is also a global minimum point.